Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
They have to know that it's false because, of course, their military expenditures presuppose the falsity of that myth. I mean, Dick Cheney, of course, put it best. He said that Reagan showed that deficits don't matter. That was effectively a way of saying that the intermediated scarce private capital myth is indeed a myth, that it's false. And so he knew it. And I think a lot of these right-wing Republicans know it, and they show that they know it when it comes to certain forms of expenditure. But then they immediately talk out of the other sides of their mouth and sound like austerians when the would-be expenditure has something to do with, you know, bettering public infrastructure or bettering the public wheel.
That's today's featured guest, Dr. Bob Hockett, providing but one example of how the prevailing myth of scarcity of money is used by the established money purveyors to culturally lock in their franchise of debt. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute, and Ellen's co-host for another edition of Looking at What's Going On with Our Money. Bob Hockett is one of those rare economic intellectuals and academics who actually gained his professional insights from first-hand experience of living with real-world mechanics of money. One of his earliest such adventures was living under a bridge with homeless workers who were unable or had great difficulty in getting ahead financially, something statistically that most Americans are currently dealing with, according to data which shows that almost 80% of our fellow citizens live paycheck to paycheck. Hockett describes this reality as a predictable systemic outgrowth of our monetary system, which is built on fallacious theories that prop up the exploitive aspects of market-focused capitalism. Ellen's conversation with Bob Hockett will be along after a bit. And later on, we'll hear from author and monetary maven Robert Bowes, who provides a first synoptic installment from his new book. He'll be exposing the story of money and usury. But now let's connect with Ellen and review some of what's underway in our world of money and the emerging movement to rescue our financial system from the hands of mere profiteers.
We were expecting to see a Federal Reserve interest rate increase, and that didn't happen. We talked about it last time, Ellen, but why didn't it happen? What's up with that?
Well, it's not clear that they were planning to raise it August 1st, but they didn't anyway. So my last article that I talked about it on our last chat was on Trump criticizing the Fed, saying that he wasn't happy about them raising rates. He said, "I appreciate that you're independent, just saying, you know, just saying as a private person that it was hurting the economy, that every time they took a step forward, then the Fed would take a step backward in tightening rates." But it's not clear which side Trump is on here, because he said recently, last week, that China's stock market had dropped significantly, and he was attributing that to his tough trade policies. And he said it's working, you know, they're coming to the table, or they're getting closer to negotiating because we had put stress on their economy. And one way that we stressed it was the strong dollar is hard on all those economies. And one reason for the strong dollar is the increase in interest rates. So you could argue that he's actually in favor of a tight money policy just now until China comes to the table, as he alleges, and then they can ease up. So who knows? It's interesting to watch. But they really shouldn't be raising rates at this time. If you read the conventional news, CNBC, that type of business news, they're all saying the economy is doing great, that unemployment is nice and low, and the inflation rate is right where the Fed wants it. And so they don't seem to be bothered about interest rates going up. But we have two economies, and they never talk about our half of the economy, okay, the stock market's doing fine and big business is doing fine, but the people are heavily in debt, more in debt than ever. The students are in worse shape than ever. I mean, it's criminal, really, the fact that people go to college to improve themselves so they can get a better job. And what happens is they're coming out of college with $100,000 or $200,000 in debt, and there's no way they can get out of it. It compounds. Nobody told these young, whatever, 19-year-olds that when they signed up for those loans that the interest was going to be tacked on the end and compound regularly. So their debts are actually going up, even though they're paying them off. So they can't buy houses. And one way that you stimulate the economy is not only when people buy houses, I mean, they're just usually buying something that's already there. So that's not really adding to GDP. In fact, it adds to a bubble in housing. But if you have a new house, then you'll buy a dishwasher and all these other things. I think it's something like $130,000 or something. They figure that every new home purchase adds to GDP because people go out and buy all this other stuff. I mean, that seems excessive. But anyway, it does stimulate the economy to have young people be able to buy their first home.
It's a hugely depressing aspect on the economy and on the culture to have this sort of debt load, this unrestrained and unstoppable debt growth, as a third of the people who are under, 34, living at home with their parents and not proceeding to take their place in the consumer economy. It's a real tragedy. It's a $1.4 trillion market of debt that belongs to these young people. And is it not possible for them to just wipe that out like they did for the banks back in 08?
Well, you can't wipe it out, but what you could do is refinance it. Put it on the debt, put it on the books of the Federal Reserve instead of on the books of the banks. In other words, the Fed could buy that debt off the banks just like it bought those toxic mortgage-backed securities off the banks. Actually, that was supposed to be the point of my article, that we shouldn't have an independent Federal Reserve, that not that we want to give it to the president to control, but they should rewrite the Federal Reserve Act to have the Federal Reserve mandated to serve the economy and to serve people instead of only serving the banks, which is where the way the Federal Reserve Act is written now. Even when Ben Bernanke was asked if couldn't he just make the same sort of low-interest loans to state and local governments, he said no, he couldn't do it because it wasn't in the Federal Reserve Act. He's only allowed to lend to certain things. So they should change that and allow the Federal Reserve to actually do quantitative easing for the people. There's no reason that, like you said, that they couldn't save the students in the same way that they saved the banks from those toxic mortgage-backed securities. Or if you think that's like partisan, just favoring the students, then use that ability of the deep pocket of the Federal Reserve to refinance the federal debt. The debt would not be a problem. $21 trillion wouldn't hurt anything if it didn't have interest attached. But the problem is that it keeps creeping up every year because of $0.5 trillion worth of interest, which is projected to be $1 trillion worth of interest annually by 2027 at the rate they're going. Or let the Federal Reserve fund infrastructure interest-free, or make zero interest loans to state and local governments. All those things would help the economy, get things going, and the only reason, well, the alleged reason why they don't do it is because quantitative easing is supposed to be sterilized. But what that means is that it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't do any good. Sterilized means that you don't really give the money away. You want to be able to pull it back when the economy allegedly gets overheated. So what the Fed does is these swaps where the bank gets reserves, which is the type of money that the Federal Reserve creates. So they get reserves in their reserve account, and then the Fed gets the mortgage-backed securities or the federal securities or whatever it is it just bought from the banks. And then they can reverse that by the Fed can then sell that stuff back into the economy and take the reserves back. Whereas if you actually funded infrastructure, let's say, the money would be out there, and then there's a question how you would bring it back. But you don't need to bring it back, or the central bank doesn't need to bring it back. It can be the federal government that brings it back in taxes. But I would argue, and I have argued at length in this book I just finished, that they wouldn't need to do that, that infrastructure will increase taxes automatically. In other words, it will stimulate the economy, and this will cause more taxes to go back to the federal government at the current rate. You know, you don't have to increase the tax rate. What you will do is generate more taxes automatically by generating more jobs and generating more infrastructure.
Yeah, now one of the things that was rather provocative about that article that you said Trump and the Fed, what I thought was very provocative, because it raised the prospect that now there are empty seats on the Federal Reserve Board, and these are the positions that are filled by presidential appointments. They've got about four openings. Potentially a majority could be established on the Federal Reserve Board, which might be able to move that policy toward a more public interest sort of direction. Although that may or may not be the case for, you know, for the person naming it now. Anyway, do you think that Trump is thinking in those terms at all, like kind of like he's doing the Supreme Court?
Well, I would guess he's definitely thinking about stacking the board, as they say. There are supposed to be seven members of the Federal Reserve Board, and then there are five members on the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets interest rates. You know, there are 12 Federal Reserve banks, and of those, five get on the Federal Open Market Committee, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. So they're privately owned, and they are not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests because they say they are privately owned.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to put five members on the FOMC, one of whom is always the head of the New York Federal Reserve, which means basically Wall Street. So Wall Street has the loudest voice on the FOMC. And then currently there are only three members out of a potential seven from the Federal Reserve Board. And two of them were appointed by Trump, confirmed by the Senate, but he recommends them. And so there's four left that he could appoint potentially. And he's got two that he has recommended and that are going through the process. But then the question is, first of all, would they change Fed policy? Is that the people he's appointing? And second of all, even if that would be the president's intent, once they're off doing their thing, the president doesn't have any control. So it seems to me the better approach, first of all, people don't necessarily trust a particular president. And second of all, we're a nation of laws, not a nation of, you know, somebody at the top appoints the other people and makes the policies. So they should change the law. They should change the Federal Reserve Act to require it to respond to the public interest. It should be a public utility, in other words, with a mandate to serve the public. And I think that would fix it. We have one example, which would be the Bank of North Dakota, which has been called a mini-Fed for the state of North Dakota, and it has a mandate to serve the public, and it does serve the public. I've never heard anyone complain of corruption in the Bank of North Dakota. I mean, some people complain about some decisions they've made, but the North Dakotans aren't complaining. In other words, they do seem to be representing their own people and doing what their own people want. That's what they're supposed to do. They're not overpaid. In fact, they're underpaid compared to other banking staff. And they seem to, they're North Dakotans, you know.
Yeah.
They have that attitude. Yeah. I know in New Jersey there, somebody said, you know, the reason why they said the Bank of North Dakota model didn't work was that this is not North Dakota. This is New Jersey, for God's sake.
Yeah, well, that's of course is a nationwide sensibility because of how belittled government roles have, how they have been belittled over recent years, and yet we have lots of experience of people in public office making great contributions to the country, and hopefully we can get back to that. And for example, in Los Angeles, we now have this motion or this movement toward a public bank. There, the city council has approved a referendum, which is necessary for them to be able to authorize creating a bank for the city. That's a pretty exciting prospect. the ballot question on that. Would you be able to just share that brief statement with us now so that you could, so people would have a chance to get a sense of what the citizens there are looking at, and maybe they can even envision their own city doing something like this?
Well, okay, we get 300 words, which isn't much. This may not be the final version, but this is what I've got so far.
So we're just going to listen briefly to a short statement that the voters will see when they get to the polls in Los Angeles that describes the proposition of should they vote yes or no on the proposition to allow the city of Los Angeles to pursue a creation of a publicly owned bank for the city. A huge breakthrough if that does occur, because it's the second largest city in the country, but it's also a breakthrough in the whole movement toward creating public banks. And there's a lot of interest all across the state of California and really around the country to move in that direction. So here's what the initial workup of that proposition wording. Here's what Ellen has written on this. The LA City Council divested city funds from Wells Fargo after that bank was caught in massive consumer fraud. The question then was, where to put the money? The risky practices of Wall Street banks triggered the 08-09 financial crisis, eliminating trillions of dollars of household wealth and causing millions to lose their homes. The big banks continue those risky practices in service to maximizing their corporate profits. The only state unscathed by the 2008-09 debacle was North Dakota, which has owned its own bank since 1919. This measure is a first step in authorizing Los Angeles to pursue that successful precedent. Voting yes on this measure is cost-free and risk-free and does not require the city to form a bank. It just clears one regulatory hurdle toward doing it. A sound business plan with prudent underwriting standards would still be required. A city-owned bank would have the cost of financing the city's debt, saving $5,000 per household on a debt that currently averages $20,000 each, that's each citizen. Other benefits that a professionally managed Los Angeles city-owned bank could provide include insulation from global financial crises, avoiding paying over $100 million annually in Wall Street fees, having the cost of financing infrastructure, assisting smaller banks and credit unions in making low-interest loans for local needs, and E, managing public funds transparently and accountably, avoiding risky and socially and environmentally destructive investments, and F, reinvesting bank profits in the local economy rather than enriching big bank shareholders and CEOs. Publicly owned banks are common internationally and are the subject of dozens of city and state initiatives across the United States. The nation looks to California for innovation. This is our opportunity to create a bank that will keep our money at home to invest in our community. Vote yes on this measure. All right.
All right.
Well, you've got my vote.
Speaking of politicians who actually have the best interests of the people at heart, we had this amazing win of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York against a longtime incumbent, and she's running for Congress. So she was out here, I think, a week ago, and she spoke along with Trinity, the head of the Public Bank LA group. Trinity Tron got to speak with her. Anyway, she endorses a public bank, but I'm just so impressed with these young people, these millennials, that are really the ones that have taken it and run with it here in L.A. And are who got the fire under the L.A. City Council. Originally, they were the ones that persuaded the L.A. City Council to pull their money out of Wells Fargo, and then public banking was the natural sequel to that, because the question was, then where do you put your money? And you don't want to put it in Chase or Citibank or any of those other banks that have also been caught in very fraudulent and risky and detrimental practices. So anyway, I think it is a new age, a new era with a new attitude among voters, young voters, and they've come up through this system where they have a strike against them from the start. I mean, when I grew up, things were easy. College was almost free. Berkeley was free when I went there. and it was easy to buy a home, it was easy to get a job, so we were considered the me first generation. And that's sort of what they've been stuck with. So now they're out there really fighting for it. So I think there actually is hope because there's a new attitude among people.
We're seeing that all over the country in terms of healthcare the same way. So as 100 years ago, the Bank of North Dakota was with a public option to the Wall Street banks that were running roughshod and extracting all of the wealth from that community, we have the same action today, and now we have people, the millennials, as you identify them, calling for public options in banking and healthcare. It's a democratic socialism, if you will, but I think the idea that the public interest needs to finally have some power behind it so that public policy can be crafted around what the people want and need instead of just what Wall Street demands. Well, Ellen, it's been nice talking to you about this, and we'll see what happens next, huh?
All right. Good to talk to you. It's my great pleasure to be speaking with Bob Hockett, who is Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School and a former advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the International Monetary Fund, and was formerly Bernie Sanders' financial regulation spokesman, among other achievements. So it's great to be speaking with you, Bob.
Thanks so much, Ellen. It's so great to be with you. Always an honor.
So you have a really impressive resume, but you also have an interesting history. It seems you started out living under bridges with the homeless. Not that you needed to be homeless, but, you know, you were just studying the situation. So what really prompted me to see if you'd be interested in interview today was a paper you wrote called Finance Without Financiers, in which you argued that banks should be considered public franchises or public utilities, as we say in the public banking movement. So I totally agree with you on that, and that was great because I got some good authoritative quotes out of it. But do you want to go into your thinking on that? And
sure.
You would define like three different models and why the old model isn't true, and there's a new model now, and that changes our whole perspective on what banks are all about.
Sure. So, you know, if you specialize in the field of financial law or finance regulatory law, which has been among my two or three sort of specializations as a lawyer, and in particular as an academic lawyer, you can't help but be struck by the pervasiveness of a particular picture and the pervasive influence of this picture, you know, well outside even of the realm of finance regulatory law, just basically across many, many different fields of law. And this foundational picture is what I call, both in that paper and in other work, the intermediated scarce private capital myth, right? So this is a picture that essentially assumes, and this is a very sort of neoclassical picture, it's commonly encountered among orthodox economists and in orthodox economic thinking. It's encountered in all orthodox finance thinking and orthodox bank thinking and bank writing, and of course in all orthodox legal thinking that is related to banking or finance law. So, you know, you'll find this myth articulated again and again in the leading law school casebooks on banking and financial institutions law, in the leading books on money and banking or financial institutions in markets in business schools, and of course in economics texts all over the place. And it goes, you know, roughly something like this. You'll always hear that banking or financial institutions of other kinds, or even financial markets, and certainly the financial system as a whole, basically serve to, quote unquote, connect savers with users, or to connect what they call more generically sometimes surplus units with deficit units. And so the picture is you've got a bunch of virtuous savers out there, you know, and all the wealth do. Save their money, they husband their resources, they don't spend profligately like the poor do. You know, they save their money, and so they accumulate these vast, you know, bank accounts or other sorts of transaction accounts or savings accounts of one kind or another or other sorts of financial instruments. And then what they do is they put their money, their scarce money that they have worked very hard to accumulate over time, at the disposal of those who have not been so provident or so fortunate, and who therefore, you know, have need of these scarce funds, either to, quote-unquote, engage in so-called consumption smoothing over time, or to invest in, sort of new enterprises that will bring more material wealth to the so-called real economy and to all of us, or to people who, need a little bit of help to kind of get over a rough patch or to help them out in a pinch, so they can borrow, for a fee from these savers. Now, this picture, I suspect that every one of your listeners is familiar with this picture. And indeed, most of them probably, I shouldn't say most because your listeners are probably much better educated precisely because they're your listeners, but maybe a lot of your first-time listeners probably assume the truth of this picture because it's heard so often and it sounds so intuitively right. But, of course, as you and I know, and as a number of our compatriots and fellow travelers know, nothing could be further from the truth. But what was worth pointing out first
is... We also have Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. I mean,
exactly.
Actually is the way it used to be. When we were on a gold standard, there really was a limited amount of money, and you really did need to have the gold before you could lend, or at least a certain portion of it. That's actually your second model. But,
there was a time when pre-accumulation was required, yeah. But and the thing is, what people, I think, are less aware of, not only is that it's false, but also just how pervasive and how sort of mischievous or pernicious it can be. You find it, for example, in bankruptcy law, right? Most of the policy that is sort of given expression in bankruptcy law is predicated on an assumption of this particular picture that capital is inherently scarce, privately supplied, and privately accumulated. Lots of other prescriptions, right, that the government has to be careful about spending too much because it might invoke or evoke the wrath of the so-called bond vigilantes, mm-hmm. or that the government might crowd out.
The pension funds, it seems to me, are operating on the wrong model. I mean, they assume that they have to pay their pensions years into the future out of the interest from their savings.
Yes.
But they could just be paying as you go, and it would be much more efficient. You'd have great pools of money that are currently off there doing, not much or not doing anything good for the local community. They're invested in Wall Street somehow.
Yeah, that's right. And because people assume that pre-accumulation is not only pervasive, but also is necessary, that it's sort of the only way, right? And then when people talk about, how the government has to sort of limit its expenditure, not only for fear of scaring the treasury bond vigilantes or, living beyond its means and burdening our grandchildren, which is the other cliche, but also because it might, quote unquote, crowd out the private investors. That's another manifestation of this. These are all, inherently reactionary policy prescriptions. They're all inherently sort of self-hamstringing or self-crippling prescriptions, and they're all either predicated on the intermediated scarce private capital myth, or they cynically deploy or cynically make use of other people's assumption that that myth is the truth as sort of rhetorical devices when it comes to sort of advocating what they want to advocate. A lot of reactionaries in the government now, of course, they have to know that it's false because, of course, their military expenditures all themselves presuppose the falsity of that myth. I mean, Dick Cheney, of course, put it best about 10-some-odd years ago, 14, 15 years ago now, when he said that Reagan showed that deficits don't matter. That was effectively a way of saying that the intermediated scarce private capital myth is indeed a myth in the pejorative sense of that word, that it's false. And so he knew it. And I think a lot of these right-wing Republicans know it, and they show that they know it when it comes to certain forms of expenditure. But then they immediately talk out of the other sides of their mouth and sound like austerians when the would-be expenditure has something to do with, bettering public infrastructure or bettering the public wheel, the common wheel. So, one of the things I think you and I have been trying to do and working so hard to do in recent years and decades is effectively to explode that myth, and that's part of what the Finance Without Financiers piece is meant to do. It's meant not only to sort of expose the myth, so to speak, but to show, and not only to say that it's false, but to show that it is false and to show how it is false, to show exactly how it is false, to show exactly what you have to look at and pay attention to in the actual workings of the financial system as we have it, to see the falsity of that myth. Because all of that, I think, is a sort of a prerequisite to seeing how then we can put our financial system, as and it is our financial system, to much, much better use. I mean, the thing is, there's a sense in which I think that the best way of looking at this, it seems to me, is to say the sovereign public is itself generating the money, right? We generate the credit, but
right,
we
right.
do so via a particular institutional infrastructure. And that infrastructure is effectively a kind of public-private partnership, right? Whether we're self-conscious of it or not, it's just the way it functions. It just is that. And it's effectively a partnership between our public bank, known as the Fed, which doesn't, to put the point mildly, doesn't always act as if it were a public bank, but it is indeed a public bank. So what we effectively have is a kind of public-private partnership between our public bank, which is our central bank, and it's called central for a reason, known as the Federal Reserve, on the one hand, and the private banking institutions whose loans it, quote-unquote, accommodates on the other hand, right? And to me, this term accommodation, which I use to sort of name or designate the connection, the relation between bank credit money generation on the one hand and then Fed accommodation of, in other words, public recognition and vindication of those particular loans on the other hand, is the process of accommodation. And that is the core of, that's in a sense the core concept. It is the mechanism through which we currently, as a public, generate our own money supply, but do so through the mechanism, you know, through the instrumentalities of these private banking institutions. And
well,
if they were functioning correctly.
The central bank is even central to that, because it seems to me that, I agree, we the people individually create the money, in the sense that if you try to write an IOU out to your grocer, he wouldn't take it. So
right.
you go to the bank, and the bank will trade you your IOU for the bank's IOU, which is designated in Federal Reserve notes or, you know, real money, and people will take that. But it's because the bank has essentially guaranteed your IOU. I mean, the bank's going to pay whether or not you ultimately pay the bank. So they have, in effect, monetized your credit. And it seems to me that, in a way, the central bank just responds to that. I mean, when the bank creates so much of that money that there's not enough reserves to be transferring it back and forth between banks, then somebody winds up with an overdraft on their reserve account, and then the Fed creates some more reserves and puts it, you know, advances it to that
bank. And that's
bank.
When it becomes that's when it becomes transparent, right? I mean, in effect, what's going on is we have essentially outsourced a particular task that is a public task, but we've outsourced it to private instrumentalities known as the banks. And what the banks are doing is disseminating essentially the monetized full faith and credit of the United States. And that's nicely captured, of course, in the phenomenon of the Federal Reserve note itself. You as a lawyer, of course, know very well, and I as a lawyer know, and many other lawyers will know, that the word note doesn't sort of abbreviate, you know, note to your girlfriend or note to your boyfriend or something. Note means promissory note. So in effect, I refer to this sometimes as the big swap. Effectively, what happens when you go, of course, into a private banking institution to take out a loan, you, of course, write out a promissory note of your own, and you swap it for a public promissory note known as a Federal Reserve note or its depository equivalent. And the reason is exactly the reason that you pointed to, which is that other people will accept the public promissory note but not the private promissory note. And this in itself nicely symbolizes the sense in which what's going on is these private institutions are in effect, if they're operating correctly, they're playing a gatekeeping role. They're determining who is creditworthy enough to swap private notes for public notes for, right? Who we're going to allow to do that. And if they're doing that job correctly, right, they're only doing this for so-called, you know, worthwhile projects and projects that actually benefit, that, you know, first of all, that, you know, the loans that can be paid back, but more importantly, ultimately, I think, for projects that are going to make individuals better off and make society as a whole better off, that are going to improve effectively the material living standards of all of us. That's at least ideally how the system works, and that's, of course, how the private bankers will describe what they're doing. They'll leave out the public bit, of course, but they'll say that what they're doing is essentially financing more wealth creation or more, you know, sort of material improvement to sort of, you know, our lives. But the problem, as you know, of course, is that the credit creation function or the credit generation function, because we outsourced it and because we attached a private profit motive to it, which wouldn't have happened if we had kept it all in-house and kept it public, we've basically provided incentives for the outsourcees, right, the private institutions that we outsource the function to. We've given them incentives essentially to sort of extend that credit for purposes of speculation on price movements in secondary markets, rather than for purposes of the sort of production of greater material well-being for all of us, you know, for society as a whole. In other words, it's all in the secondary market. I shouldn't say all, but it's largely in the secondary markets now rather than in the primary markets. And as you know, the secondary market's just about speculation on price movements. It's not about producing new sources and forms of material well-being that everybody can enjoy.
I wonder how you would make those decisions of what is a good publicly oriented use of money.
So I think there are a couple things that one could do. And I'm thinking now that the ultimate answer is to bring the swapping function back in-house, so to speak. So just to sort of remind ourselves for one moment, this swapping function is essentially what most people refer to as private bank lending, right? So the function is to, under certain circumstances, we let people temporarily trade in their private promissory notes for public promissory notes, which they can then spend, and thereby engage in various salutary productive activities, right? Now, the reason that we initially outsourced it, the original reason, I think, it has to do with the time that we put all of this in place, which was over the course of about a 50 to 60 year period, culminating in the creation of the Federal Reserve a little over 100 years ago. So back in those days, I think the thought probably was that it's not feasible for the public, for the central government to have offices all over the country sort of making credit allocation decisions. That would have required a much larger sort of public infrastructure than I think people thought was possible at the time, given the fact that this far-flung continental empire, which we had become, was still not fully integrated, and technologically it was kind of difficult to fully integrate it. You add to this the fact that the private banks back in those days, as you know, were required by law to be local, right? Everybody's become completely used to now the fact that banks can branch across state lines and become giant mega banks. So for literally 21 years now, those restrictions have been gone, and we've kind of forgotten them as a culture. But before then, right, there were very strict limits, and especially 100 years ago, banks were required to be local. And so it was a little bit more plausible to think of banks as being Jimmy Stewart banks. They were required to be local and small. But now think about how things have changed, right? Here we are 100 some odd years later. Private banking institutions are no longer localized. They're not required to be localized, and they tend not to be. And as we know, branches have shut down in lots of neighborhoods and inner city areas where they didn't used to be non-existent, but now they are. And they've become bigger, and their interests have sort of shifted away from their communities to sort of bigger and better, quote-unquote, things like, again, speculation on secondary markets. Meanwhile, we've got communication technologies now and that make it much more feasible for the public sector, for the federal government, to know about, how things work in the local areas. And we have the capacity actually to open up public banks, actual public banks that do operate locally and at the community level in the way that private banks once did until 20 some odd years ago. And so it seems to me that the time has probably come to switch over, basically putting an end to the outsourcing strategy that no longer makes sense and is no longer necessary now, and have actual either public branch offices of the Federal Reserve or state-organized counterparts, right, state public banks, or both. We could have a parallel system, just as we have both state-chartered private banks and nationally-chartered private banks. Do something like that instead of doing the outsourcing. And I think that would work. It's no longer, therefore, necessary to use private institutions. And furthermore, private institutions have shown that they're not really up to the task anymore, particularly now that we've deregulated them to the point where we allow them to become gigantic and to cross state lines and become regional or even national or even global banks.
So you have Wall Street banks that are making local decisions, if they're lending at all locally.
If at all,
so
yeah.
They certainly are not right here. So I was interested in your take on Bitcoin and blockchain. I saw a quote in U.S. News where they quoted you as saying that ultimately the Fed will commandeer one or another distributed ledger technology and make it the basis for the new payment system. But I wonder if did you really mean distributed ledger? Because the Fed is by definition centralized. A distributed ledger is pretty expensive and energy intensive, and you don't need that if you're a central government.
Yeah, so it's hard to tell at this point, of course, because we're in a state of flux, but there are a few things that are, I think, maybe worth noting. Right? So the first is that central banks worldwide and the Fed itself are all sort of looking at ways to sort of upgrade their payment systems. The payment system that we have now, and of course, central banks typically administer those payment systems. The Fed, of course, administers our national payment system, and that's, in a way, that's the sort of, you can think of that as the sort of hardware infrastructure through which this process of what I called accommodation occurs, right? The Fed recognizes a payment that's made out of a bank deposit account, and it accommodates that payment even if it turns out that the bank in question is in trouble, right? It'll, in the end, it'll, of course, seize that bank, or with the FDIC, it will seize that bank and bail it out and sort of reconstruct it, or, you know, part it out, or do whatever it has to do. But it's not going to say, oh, sorry, we're not going to recognize this particular check drawn on this account or this particular payment made on this account because we administer the payment system and we need a reliable payments infrastructure. So, you know, the payment system is sort of central to the Fed's mission, and it's central to most central banks' mission. It's one of the core things it does, and currently the system is a little bit long of tooth, right? The Fedwire system and other sort of electronic systems that sort of interface with it, they work fine, right? But there's not real-time clearing and settlement. There's a little bit of a delay. They're still a little bit less than perfect in that sense. And so the Fed, as you know, is looking into new technologies that it might adopt as a way of sort of upgrading. In that quote then that you saw, and I've given sort of similar quotes quite a bit over the last year or so, what I really mean when I say, you know, one or another form of DLT is basically some new payments infrastructure, which will probably involve some form of cryptography for the sake of security, right? So there'll be some kind of crypto elements to it. My guess is that we're going to have some, you know, some version of the sort of electronic platform or the digital platform that's used by the cryptocurrencies that we see now, some version of it, some energy efficient version, some reliable version, some easily administered version, will ultimately be sort of commandeered by the Fed in the same way that the Fed itself is the upshot of a commandeering of the old New York clearinghouse system that had evolved privately and spontaneously at the turn of the last century, back, you know, sort of late in the 19th, early in the 20th century, when we decided that we need some kind of a decentralized central bank. So going back to your question about distributed and the relation between it and centralized, it's worth noting that the Federal Reserve System, quote unquote, itself is a kind of a hybrid system between centralization and decentralization. Most jurisdictions that have central banks, as you know, have truly purely centralized central banks, right? The Bank of England is a central bank in the fullest sense of the word. The Riksbank of Sweden, which is the oldest continuously operating central bank, centralized in the same way. Likewise, Bank of the Netherlands Central Bank, which is another one of the first ones. We in this country, you know, have this kind of fetish about distributedness, which is not always a bad thing. At the governmental level, we refer to this form of distributedness as federalism. So the idea is, you know, we have kind of decentralized sovereignty, or sort of dissipated or diffuse sovereignty, where it's partly vested in 50 different states, maybe 51 if Puerto Rico becomes a state, but also partly centralized at the federal level. And we decided to do the same thing, of course, when it came to finally realizing that we need some kind of central bank in the lead up to 1913. And so what we did is we established this kind of system of different regional Federal Reserve banks that were sort of public-private hybrid institutions that would then be sort of coordinated and regulated centrally by the Federal Reserve Board itself, which is a standard, you know, executive agency, although it's actually much more than other agencies now, located in D.C. And we built it on a pre-existing infrastructure that was operating, you know, better than nothing, but that was, not, you know, sort of suboptimally operating. And in our view, what we were doing was optimizing it by federally commandeering it. That was a clearinghouse system, which was essentially a system of risk pooling, basically liquidity risk pooling, that had been developed by private banking institutions. There were a number of clearinghouses, as you know, in the late 19th century, The best functioning one at the time, or at least the most prominent and most famous one, probably for obvious reasons, was the old New York clearinghouse system. And this was, of course, because New York by that point had long since emerged as a sort of financial center of the country. And this was essentially a kind of a liquidity risk pooling system. And what we did effectively was to commandeer that function. We said, okay, we're going to call liquidity risk pooling reserve sharing, and we're going to have a federal reserve system, and essentially reserves are going to be shared by the members of this system, just as they were being shared by members of the old clearinghouse system. And of course, the term clearinghouse also suggests something else. The word clearing has to do with clearing of one another's notes or clearing of checks drawn upon one another's accounts. So there was a kind of primitive privatized form of accommodation going on there too. Basically, each member of the system, of the clearinghouse system, would accommodate payments made on other members of the system. And we said, well, let's nationalize that system since it's a de facto public utility, and let's optimize it by backing it up with the full faith and credit of the United States. And furthermore, let's regulate it in a manner that deals with some of the perverse incentives that are raised by the profit motives being central to it. And that's essentially what gave us the Federal Reserve System. Effectively, that phenomenon, I call this the sort of, it's a regulatory dialectic, where we allow an infrastructure to develop privately, and then when it comes time to optimize it, we simply commandeer it publicly. The same thing, I believe, is going to happen with respect to so-called fintech.
Well, I wonder if we need reserves. I mean, if the banks were, in fact, franchises, I mean, you could certainly have private banks, or private lending institutions that actually are lending existing money, not creating money. But if you have a public system, what do you need reserves for? I mean, we all acknowledge that banks are just creating money out of thin air. They have to balance their books, but balance against what? You're just pulling it out of the cloud anyway, right?
Right. So the answer is you don't need reserves, and this is true both for the sort of theoretical
models.
Exactly. I mean, this is true for the theoretical reason that you yourself had drawn attention to, and that the three models that I sort of lay out in the Finance with the Financiers paper layout. But it's also verifiable in the sense that there are comparable jurisdictions to our own that don't impose reserve requirements. In the UK, there are no reserve requirements. And nobody would say that the British banking system is a primitive system or that it's somehow backward or anything. Far from it. In many ways, the British system is always about 5 to 10 years ahead of ours, as I suppose makes sense given that the British financial system is one that we sort of patterned ours after. And we always, in the past, used to take our lead from the British. So you definitely don't need them. And indeed, in the paper I'm writing now, I'm working on a paper at the moment. It's called The People's Ledger. Then the subtitle is A Citizen's Fed. Citizens in the plural possessive, right? So a Fed owned business. And what I'm essentially arguing for here, this basically is the sort of bringing the functions back in-house, as I put it before, and eliminating the outsourcing, eliminating the franchise system and making it all public. Effectively, what would happen here is basically private banking institutions, insofar as we allow them to make loans of any kind at all, are going to, instead of opening up accounts for the people to whom they lend, are instead going immediately to open Federal Reserve accounts for those citizens. In other words, when you take out a loan, instead of having, you know, from a private banking institution, not that you or I probably do that much anymore now that we found, you know, better public alternatives, a bank that extends credit to us will in effect be quote unquote credited by the Fed. But the account will now be a Fed account that you and I will be able to draw on sort of immediately. And private banking institutions will not then be holding deposited monies. And what that's ultimately going to lead us into, I think, is essentially a kind of a sort of a gradual extinction of private banks in the way that we have found them thus far. And insofar
that's
as private,
because I'm just finishing up a book, and that's exactly what I'm saying too.
Oh my goodness, we should compare notes on this. We maybe
right,
maybe we ought to write a book
send
together.
You my draft. We can trade drafts.
Let's trade draft.
I have a hard deadline of July 15th, so I'm almost
okay. Yeah, let's trade draft, and maybe we can. Maybe you know we ought to think about writing some papers or books together, because it seems like the trajectory of our thinking is almost identical. You know, it's kind of a. I think this is further vindication, in a sense, of the truth that we both are sort of trying to channel here, that we both independently have stumbled onto it, so to speak, or have sort of found ourselves there, you know. That suggests
okay,
that there's something
I like it.
Deep about it, you know. But yeah, I think you're quite right. There's no need for that, of course, raises the question, why are there deposits? And why do banks actually look for them or seek them? And I think there's a pretty simple answer to this. They constitute a source of very cheap funding for the private banks to use in more speculative secondary market activities, right? There's a reason that all of these shadow banking institutions always want to glom on to at least one non-shadow bank, right? There's a reason that the people who are playing in the capital markets and in the money markets and in the derivatives markets and in the repo markets, there's a reason that the institutions that do all of that kind of playing always want to glom on in one way or another, typically in the form of a financial holding company, to some private banking institution. There's actually more than one reason. One reason some people are at least dimly aware of, the other reason they're less aware of. The reason they're sort of aware of is that there's a kind of public subsidy that happens then, right, because your holding company is going to be bailed out by, or it's going to be guaranteed by, or stood behind, either explicitly or implicitly, by the federal government, because once you're attached to an institution of that kind, you are systemically important, to use the phrase of art. You are, and that's just a fancy way of saying that you are a kind of public utility, but that enables you to be a public utility without saying explicitly that you are that, and thus subject yourself to the kinds of regulation that utilities are supposed to be subject to. But the other reason that gets less attention is that when the banks then have this, you know, these deposits, when they have sort of access to deposited monies, they're able, of course, to pay out very low or maybe even no interest at all and use a good bit of that pooled money then essentially to kind of subsidize or pay for or indirectly to speculate in the secondary markets themselves, right? So they want to continue to play this role of, you know, deposit holding in addition to credit creating, precisely because the deposits are useful for them to be able to sort of tap into. But there's no need of those.
We'll continue this fascinating conversation between Bob Hockett and Ellen Brown on our next edition of It's Our Money. And now, let's take a different look into the history of money and usury with guest commentator Bob Bowes.
In our new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, we identify and discuss concepts that are integral to humanity surviving its current crisis in a progressive and sustainable manner. The first six steps involve collective issues that must be understood by individuals, and the seventh step is one that each of us must take individually. Let's begin with step one, exposing the story of money and usury. We start with money because, other than consciousness, it is the central driving force of planetary events. Money is so familiar that most folks believe that they understand how it operates. We work, we get paid, and we try to balance our checkbook. But money actually functions quite differently for central bankers who create it from nothing and charge principal and interest for its use. Historically, money has been seen in two different, distinct ways, as in accounting for value and as a store of value. When money accounts for value, it operates as a credit for what we have created and/or sold through our labor, and exists only in representational form as cash or credits, which serve as the medium of exchange. When money is a store of value, it represents what is perceived as the intrinsic value of a commodity, say, gold, silver, or oil, which in themselves, or as promissory notes which represent them, act as the medium of exchange. However, these two systems of money are not separate and unassailable systems. Using terms that are common to most forms of economics, that is, labor and capital, the relationship between money as an accounting for value and money as a store of value can be expressed like this. Money begins as the value created by labor and is commodified into capital when interest is charged for its use. In most contemporary schools of economics, defining money as the value created by labor is called the labor theory of value. But in actuality, there is no theory involved. It is simply a choice to base a monetary system on labor instead of basing it on capital, which means basing a monetary system on commodities. The difference that results from this choice is obvious. When the corporate operatives that fill the Congress and the White House tell us that the environmental protections cut into corporate profits and would therefore negatively affect the economy and employment, they are saying that the exigencies of the commodity of capital are of a higher priority than life on this planet. So the choice is clear. We either base our monetary system and the resulting economic system on life or on death. Basing our monetary system on commodities is a guaranteed losing proposition for the 99%. It is a mathematical certainty. Here's why. In the U.S., U.K., EU, and most other places, the banking industries, from the central banks on down, are privately owned. Thus, private parties, beholden to the shareholders of the holding companies that control the banks and their captive transnational corporations, decide when to create money and when to stop creating it, based on the objectives of those at the top of the global power pyramid. These objectives are power, profit, propaganda, and population reduction. When you take out a loan, say at 10%, a private bank creates money and charges you interest for its use by giving you the principal amount of the loan, say $1,000. When you spend this money, it temporarily increases the money supply by $1,000. When you pay back the principal, the money supply is reduced by $1,000, which brings the total money supply back to where it started. However, you still owe the bank an interest payment, say $100. Where does this come from? From the existent money supply, which is now reduced by $100. As you can see, when this loan cycle is repeated many millions of times, the banks end up controlling an increasing percentage of the money supply, with the bank's interest income increasing as well. But the mathematical tricks do not end there. During the upswing of what the bankers call the business cycle, when the number of loans are increasing, there is an increasing amount of temporary bank money in the money supply to pay for the interest. But when the banks determine that the collateral provided by individuals and corporations for the loans has reached a significant and attractive threshold, they invent a false flag, such as Lehman Brothers in 2008, to freeze loans, crash the economy, and seize the collateralized assets, the fruits of our labor. Such a process has been repeated every 5+ years on the average since the creation of the Federal Reserve System, our private central bank. This is why, as various peer-reviewed studies have shown, the 1% end up with almost all the assets. Thus, interest is, ultimately, the theft of labor, and why a system based on commodities such as capital, gold, silver, and oil eventually destroys labor and the planet. Reporting from behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.